So I thought what we could talk about tonight, and then the next time I'm going to offer some, I don't know, kind of tips or strategies for keeping your practice going. And the time after that, we're having a monk from Australia, Ajahn Sarat, is going to beam in. It'll be 3 p.m. the day before. So he can tell us what's going to happen. So we're going to have, that's really wonderful. He was here with Clear Mountain and he's wonderful. So we're going to have him come first in February. But, one of the very significant Dharma quotes in my life that just really stuck in my head, I wanted to share it. And I don't have the quote. I couldn't find the exact quote, but I'm paraphrasing, by Digo Khinsei Rinpoche, who was a great Nyingma Lama, died in 1991. And I never met him. I wish I had. But he was this extraordinary being, you know, full-out Tibetan and Nyingma tradition. And he basically said, worldly life is easy in the beginning and hard in the end. And spiritual life is hard in the beginning and easy in the end. And this really kind of captures this challenge of our path and, you know, a whole lifetime of practice. And, you know, our friend there was kind of addressing it in one way, because it's hard in the beginning. It's hard in the beginning to get going and to know where it could lead us, and how we work with that can be a real challenge. And, you know, in the history of, say, this group, all kind of people have been here and then they've kind of vanished and they've shown up 5 years later and said, oh, I kind of stopped practicing, and all kinds of things happen. You know, I get it. And then they come back and then they, you know, whatever. It's a roller coaster for a lot of folks. And so how do you navigate that? And how do you really take that in, that almost by definition, it probably will be harder in the beginning, but by definition, it will be easier in the end, which is why, in a sense, we are doing a path of practice. And, you know, people often get started with this joy, which is wonderful. Start the path with joy, which is wonderful. But then they encounter difficulties they didn't anticipate. And sometimes people get bogged down or they get derailed or they stop. But the poignant part, if you will, is that just the things they're encountering are often just their thresholds of growth. It's just the doorway that they need to walk through. But that's hard to do, to remember that. And, you know, here in 2023 now, we're kind of, you know, we gather in Sangha, which is wonderful, but a lot of times we're out there on our own. It'd be nice if we were, you know, in 14th century Tibet or Thailand or something, but here we are. So I want to explore some of these difficulties of difficult in the beginning and maybe how they manifest in our lives and what to how to hold them to not get derailed, to help move toward growth. So I want to decode his quote a little bit, because there's a lot packed in there. And so in terms of easy in the beginning for lay life, for worldly life, you know, it's funny. I've never spent any time in bars or watering holes actually in my life. I don't even know how to do it kind of, but I do walk by windows and I've walked by windows over the years, especially pre-COVID. Like, I don't know, I remember, for some reason, I'm remembering the Red Door in Ballard. But I walk by the window, and there's all these young people in there, all enthusiastically conversing with each other. They're all kind of attractive looking. They all have nice clothes. There's a real bubbly kind of energy. And that's easy in the beginning. I mean, it's almost like a default. Yeah, okay, go get some drinks and hang out. And it's cool. It's fine. But it's you learn something from that, because it's kind of what our consumer culture wants us to emulate, to be young, to be attractive, to be vibrant in that way. And even like in cinema or movies, whatever, you know, older people, it's pretty easy to have your career in because you got old, or maybe you come in as a character bit kind of actor, but it's pretty much young and beautiful is where it's at and all that stuff. So that's easy in the beginning. But if you look at it closely, it's like, how well does that hold together? You know, how well does that hold together? Because if you fast forward 60 years, and suddenly a 25-year-old person is 85, assuming they're even still alive. It's a whole different ballgame. And oddly enough, many years ago, I used to work in a nursing home as a nurse's aide back when I lived in the commune. And I learned a lot. I mean, it really stuck with me because I got to know some people. And I remember a couple of people there who had, they had been young and attractive and vivacious in their 20s, and now they were 85, and they were kind of bitter and angry, basically. It's almost like, well, what happened? You know, it kind of caught them by surprise, like, really? But it did. And they hadn't found, just because they were facing outwards and kind of dependent upon their circumstance, they hadn't found a way to make a transition that worked for them. So it was hard. It was hard for them. I get that. But I learned from that, you know, because there's something to learn from that in terms of how we conduct our own lives. They were suffering. So we're in the spiritual path, and we're, in a sense, has to do the opposite. I mean, it's not that we can't be young or attractive. I'm not. But, you know, in terms of turning away from attachment to conditionality and looking for that which comes from the inside, that's what this is about. And that's why monks, you know, it's really been very interesting being around Clear Mountain, because you can see with those monastics how, if you really look at how they conduct their lives, it's sparse. I mean, they can't even ask for coffee, you know, or buy coffee or anything. It's got to be offered to them. And it's just this, but there's this joyousness around there. It's really amazing. We just had a nun visit. She was amazing in the same kind of way.
I can speak on that a little bit.
Okay.
I'm Stacy.
I'm recording. Let's can you hold that to the end? Yeah, let's do that, because I'm recording and it gets complicated, because I don't want to have people's talking about be out there and then, yeah, so cool. So on the other side, I'm thinking of back in 1988, I had the great honor, I think I mentioned this before, but I was in Thailand and met Ajahn Buddhadasa, who was one of the great 20th century masters. And at Swan Mok in southern Thailand. And I was... Turned out when I arrived, most of the monks had gone because they were getting ready for a 10-day retreat at Koh Samui. And I kind of said, oh, gosh, where's Ajahn Buddhadasa? And they said, oh, he's over there. You can go talk to him. And I went, really? And so I went over there, and he was sitting. I don't know if some of you may have seen photographs, but he was very unassuming. So he was sitting on a beat-up kitchen chair in the dirt with chickens on the ground around him and piles of magazines. That's what I remember. And I was sort of, this was like so long ago, I was sort of in a transition from Raja Yoga, speaking of checkered paths, and I was starting to clarify the whole question of not self versus Atman in that tradition. So I asked him, I said, is it true that there's no self in Buddhism? And he kind of looks at me and said, he just said, no self. I think that's all he said in English, but he was radiating this presence. And it just went wham, you know. I kind of said, okay. I sort of accepted it on some level. I say all this because the fruition of his practice just kind of rolled off him in waves. You could just feel it. It was almost tactile. And this was easy in the end. Even though he was 82, I did math. He was 82 when I met him, died 5 years later. But there was a sense of this fulfillment. And he went through a rough, I mean, I've read his biography. He was very self-initiating. He just went off in his beat up lot out in the jungle somewhere and just started practicing on his own, all by himself. You know, so it was not easy for him in the beginning, but he really kept to it. And it's extraordinary what he became. So we can kind of take that in our hearts in terms of how we set our priorities. You know, it's not black and white, but there's a lot of choices to be made. And the same with Dukkha Kinsay Rinpoche. He did a ton of practice and just really focused himself on the practice and became this extraordinary being. So that's part of our possibility in, you know, even within our circumstance of lay life and the families and people we love and whatever we have to do to be able to do that, to be able to change and flourish or flower, perhaps you could say, to find this freedom and joy. But getting to easy in the end doesn't come without effort. And this whole thing about obstacles, it's like a huge part of the literature of Dharma. People coming up against all kinds of barriers, internal and external, and what do? You know, Achan Chah, he struggled with sexuality to an enormous degree when he's a young man, trying to stay celibate. And he had a tiger, there's a great story. I don't know if you've ever read Stillness Flowing, his biography, which I'd highly recommend. It's really wonderful. And you can download it from Abhayagiri is the best way. Oh, you can get it. It's just thick, so download it. But I would. He had a tiger, like literally, they hit the, what's the word? I can't remember the word, but they have an umbrella and they're sitting underneath it. And he had a glot. There you go. Thank you. Yep. And I had a tiger like outside, well, just him and a mosquito net between the tiger who was breathing on him so he could smell its breath. And in fact, some monastics do get eaten, or did back then, did get eaten by. So it wasn't a complete fantasy that he was afraid of, but he went through it. But for us, we probably don't have tigers so much, but we have inner stuff, you know, inner tigers that to face, that come up, that can knock us down. And that's where to remember, you know, to work with this idea, I think it's really helpful that it can be hard in the beginning and easy in the end. And to work with that is so powerful. So I want to take a little look at a few aspects of inner entanglements, how to think about that, and a little bit at the five hindrances, which touch on this also. So another, I have a few favorite quotes, and forgive me if I bored you with this one, but the mind is luminous, obscured by visiting defilements. It just really, to me, that just sort of, the path is right there. It's in the numerical discourses of the Buddha. The mind is luminous, obscured by visiting defilements. Lots of discussion goes on there in, out in there. Dharma discussion about the meaning of that. But in a way, if the mind is luminous, what it suggests is our natural state is luminous and happy. Our conditioned state is often anything but. And the spiritual path is how we free ourselves of the conditions so we can relax into what's underlying. And you see that in practice, you know, when we sit, stuff comes up. And when the stuff doesn't come up, then we're there. But in between is all this stuff, which comes from, you know, this lifetime, conditioning, traumas, maybe other lifetimes, who knows what. But that's the journey. That's the journey. And when the difficulties come up, these visiting defilements, they erupt and show themselves. That's when we can get derailed. Things are hard. You know, it's like, I don't want to look at that. It's just too hard. I don't want to go through that again and again. Or it's just too disruptive. It's too unpleasant. I want to go distract myself and binge watch or drink or whatever we do. You know, that's what people do, understandably. But if we can remember that it can be easy in the end, and if we go through it, keep being aware, then slowly it starts to thin. And these things, these defilements don't block us anymore. And you know, I mean, this is a complex question, and there may be sometimes a place for someone to do counseling. Totally get that, you know, certain aspects you got to work through. But as in terms of the mindfulness practice, to become aware and to be mindful in the middle of things as they present themselves and the parts, you can sort of see the different parts and they start to disentangle. We start to see they're not inherently us. I don't know about you all, but you know, when I was in junior high school, I saw all this stuff I didn't like about myself, and I thought that was me, period, in the story. And it took me a long time to start to realize, well, actually, that was conditioning, and it wasn't me, and I could see it changing, and that sort of was one of the things that launched me on the spiritual path, was just not accepting that was inherently me. But that's hard for people to know. And so they get stuck there, and the very process of the path brings things to light that unless there's a way out, folks would rather keep hidden, understandably. And if they're not clear that we can be free of that by seeing it clearly and going through it, it's understandable. No, thank you. You know, I'll just engross myself in fast cars or whatever it is. So we got to be aware of them, and that's how we get through them. And you know, you talk to people who've been practicing a long time, and they're still aware of those things, but they've kind of faded into like the history vaults of how they understand themselves. It just doesn't grab them anymore. It doesn't have claws anymore. It's like, oh yeah, that, yeah. But it's not central anymore. And I have a feeling everybody here, you know, you've all been working the journey, so you're freer and freer. But I think that I offer this because I think it's a really useful tool, what Dhul Khyentse Rinpoche said. You know, hard in the beginning, easy in the end versus worldly life. And to just work with that as you're navigating the journey can be just really, really helpful. And another way that difficult in the beginning manifests is in the five hindrances. And I want to just, you know, roll through this a little quickly, but they're in this context. They have a certain importance, I think. And some of you know these are difficulties. Buddha pointed them out. We encounter along the way desire, aversion, restlessness, sloth and torpor, and doubt. Those are the five hindrances. And seen in this context, I think they're informative. And they are, by the way, as you might have just picked up, two sets of opposing pairs, desire and aversion, and restlessness and sloth and torpor are kind of opposite each other, and then doubt is in its own unique category. And one way to work with these is think of them as objects of mindfulness. To me, that was a huge breakthrough because I used to look at them as, you know, problems or something wrong with me. But they're objects of mindfulness. They're right there in the Satipatthana Sutta. They're in the fourth foundation. The five hindrances is a list right there. So the message is to be mindful of these things when they arise. And that's part of how we work with them to become free of them so that they're not, you know, they're hard in the beginning, but they're not going to take us out or stop us. Because that's the danger with these. They can, all those can knock somebody out and get them off the path and just kind of get lost on diversions if we don't work with them in some way that is actually helpful. So I'm going to walk through and Gil Fronsdal, great Western teacher, he says, when the hindrances are present, the path to inner peace is through them. Rather than viewing their presence as mistakes or obstacles, it is useful to turn toward them as if they are doors to walk through. They are the occasion for cultivating liberating insight and freedom. And if you ever want, he has a book, someone may know the title, about the hindrances, Gil Fronsdal does, which is a really, what's it called? You probably know. Yeah, hindrances, there you go, bingo. Yep, that's it. It's very nice. So if you all feel inspired, that's a beautiful resource. He's extraordinary. Say again? Gil Fronsdal. Yeah. Yep. So the first desire, and you know, described by the Buddha, core reason for suffering, keeps us in the wheel of samsara. We want something different from what is. We think if we get something, it'll keep us happy. Nothing inherently wrong with wanting things. It's just how we hold it. You know, we've got bodies. Bodies want stuff. That's okay. But do we stick there? And it becomes a hindrance when it drives our attention. But if we can turn to it with our practice, just be aware of it when it arises, then it's really different. And it won't take us down. It won't divert us so much. And that's a key part of hard in the beginning because, you know, sometimes practice is boring or sometimes it'd be more fun to do something else and to really stay on that. It takes something. And then we can use the skills the Buddha teaches us and start with the body, you know, because a lot of times desire is very tactile. You can feel it in your body to really be able to identify where where the buzz of desire is, where the wanting and experience is, and be aware of it and not get stuck. And just so you can see through it. And ill will is the opposite, kind of this urge to push something away because it's uncomfortable. All these great words, anger, fury, rage, resentment, indignation, irritation, vexation, discontent, loathing, and abhorrence. And these can really fill us, heart and soul, and become how we understand ourselves. And it can become very hard in the beginning if that's what, for one reason or another, it's got us in the face. So to be able to work with that, hold that as an object of mindfulness, can help get through that barrier. Because later on, it just ain't there. You know, you look at someone like the Dalai Lama. Does he have any of those things? You know, doesn't mean he doesn't feel a flicker of anger once in a while, but it doesn't stick. It doesn't become who he is. So that's easy in the end. And then sloth and torpor, you know, they're related experiences of heaviness. Gill says, sloth manifests as a physical absence of vitality. The body may feel heavy, lethargic, weary, or weak. Torpor is a lack of mental energy. The mind may be dull, cloudy, or weary, easily drifting in thought. So that's, you know, that's tough in practice, how to work with that and not to turn externally just to solve it. I mean, that's one of those difficult areas. How do you navigate that? What are the choices? But these are real fruitful places to become more aware and to keep moving ahead. And just to watch them can keep them from draining us, you know, so just mindfully experiencing them. And restlessness is the other side of the spectrum. That's kind of my weakness, if anything, is to be restless. And I try to do walking meditation. But there's a real impetus there to want to go do something fun. I mean, I can really see it. And not that sometimes that's okay, but you can see it's an alternative to the thing that I actually need to be present with. So it's part of the journey and part of how it, knowing that it's hard in the beginning, can help us work with that creatively. And we're going to get you a chance to talk about this in just a minute. Gill says, learning to breathe through restlessness is a great skill. Breathing conscious of the whole body or focusing in the ongoing rhythm of breathing in and out can calm us physically. Releasing tension or constriction in breathing can be relaxing. The more attention given to breathing, the less attention is available to fuel the restlessness or worry. And then doubt is just this, you know, doubt about the teacher, the practice, but often doubt about our own ability to fulfill the journey. That's a lot of times what doubt is. And just to be mindful of that and realize, yeah, this is hard in the beginning, manifesting, and keep going. So these are all things to work with and just to have mindful interest in them. Is kind of how to solve them. And just to not give up. I think that's so important. Just don't give up. One of my teachers, Jago Tukul Rinpoche, he often said, don't give up was the one thing I remember from his teachings. And he just urged people to just continue. You know, even in the Buddha's time, there was some, it's really interesting in the suttas, there's all these encounters with people who, I mean, they're talking to the Buddha, and they don't see the potential, or they don't see who he is enough to realize who they can be. It's quite striking. So if we don't get that on occasion, we can cut ourselves some slack because people who were face to face with him didn't get it. And there's a couple of exchanges with kings. He had two kings, Banasaki, Pasanada, that's it, I think, and Bimbisara, and especially the first one. There's this one sutta where there's this long, beautiful discussion about or teaching about the practice. And at the end of it, and the king kind of got it on one level, but at the end of it, he's sort of like, Lord, permit me to depart. I'm busy and have much to do, he says. And the Buddha says, well, do as you see fit. So there's a real sense that on some level, he didn't get it. He didn't get it what he could have done differently. So I think I'll leave it there. I'll just sit for a moment.